Hello everyone, I'm so excited to welcome you to my podcast, Talos, in partnership with SICE, The Looking Glass.
Today I'll be speaking with Ronaldo Lemos, a lawyer specializing in public policy and technology. He's the co-creator of Brazil Internet Bill of Rights, as well as Brazil National IoT Plan, as well as a professor at Columbia University and Schwarzman College. Let's get this started.
Hello, Ronaldo. Thank you so much for joining me today on this podcast. First question today is going to ask you to introduce yourself a little bit.
So I'm Ronaldo Lemos. I am a lawyer and I'm also a professor. So I have been teaching at Schwarzman College at Tsinghua University in Beijing for the past few years. I have been also a professor at Columbia University in New York at SIPA, the School of International and Public Affairs. And my entire career has been dedicated to what we can call technology policy. So I am originally from Brazil. I live in São Paulo now. And basically, I've been involved in developing and also participating in the debate about different technology policy issues that include legislation, including Brazil's internet law, and also now everything that has to do with artificial intelligence and the latest problems of the day. But I think that is a summary. I hope it's useful for you and the listeners.
Thank you so much. So let me jump back onto that a little bit. So your career evolved from working into a law firm to then working under Dilma Rousseff government. Maybe plunging into that a little bit, I saw that you were working under Rousseff government as National Council for Fighting Piracy, and then looking a little bit into different councils for communication and whether into governmental bodies about, within like to change a bit the constitution when it comes to the internet. How is that evolution? So from really being a listener to working for the government.
Sure. Well, I started working in what I do, and it's an interesting reason. Like what brought me into technology was actually an interesting thing. I like music a lot. So during the late 90s, there was the time that Napster was actually created. And basically, there was this global library of music, which at that time was actually really something unbelievable, because if you liked music, you were dependent on physical objects, basically at the time CDs, in order to get access to it. And suddenly you have this amazing thing happening, which is the possibility of listening to whatever music ever was recorded by people. So that was really a change. And interestingly, I was a law student at that time. I was working with sociology of law, which is a pretty open-ended thing. And also I was working as a sort of a legal trainee with telecommunications law. And when I saw the whole thing about Napster coming up, I basically very quickly put together these two things, so telecommunications and sociology. And I said, well, this thing about internet is going to have a huge impact in every single field of human life. And immediately I started dedicating to learning more about that from the legal perspective. I quickly found out about the work of the Berkman Center at Harvard. They were the first legal research institution within the legal field. And basically they started doing technology policy work very early. And I started reading the work of Lawrence Lessig and other people. And that was actually really impactful to what I started doing. So basically, a couple of years later, I actually went to Harvard as a student. and I started doing my LLM at Harvard. And I was one of the very first interns at the Berkman Center, which was really small at that time. And I had the opportunity to meet not only Lawrence Lessig, but also Jonathan Zittrain, Yochai Benkler, Charles Nesson, and a lot of people who are still around today, and they were like the pioneers on this particular field. And from that time onwards, we started like collaborating, and you know, that was the beginning of the whole thing. But the important thing here is it all started with music. So because of my interest in that, I went to work with copyright and a lot of other stuff. But that was exactly what brought me in this particular field.
That's impressive. How have you seen music continuing throughout your career? Is that something that's still relevant today? Are you still enjoying like that? Are you able to bridge that into your career? Because I know sometimes it's hard to bring back passions professionally.
Great thing to ask. I'm not really asked that many times, but the answer is yes. I actually never gave up on my music interest. Basically, I do the programming for a music festival in Brazil. I'm probably the only lawyer in the world that actually do curatorship for a music festival. I did it back in the 2000s for 5 years while I was being a lawyer, debating Creative Commons copyright in Brazil and a lot of other issues. For 5 years, I did the music programming for a very large festival in Brazil called TIM Festival. TIM is actually the Italian telecommunications company. They were the sponsors of this festival in Brazil. And that festival was responsible for bringing quite a lot of famous acts to Brazil for the first time, including bands like The Strokes or even Kanye West, also, you know, Arcade Fire, MIA, Daft Punk, and quite a few others. So that was, it's something that I say with a lot of pride, because Brazil is not an easy place for artists to actually to play live. And in the past 2 years, the same people that organized that festival, they are now doing a big festival in Brazil again. It's called the C6 Festival. C6 is the name of a fintech in Brazil, a pretty large one. And we are doing the same thing over again. So this year, we had quite a few artists in Brazil here, including from France. We had like Christine and the Queens, that you might be familiar, maybe. We also had John Batiste, which is a soul music artist, brilliant one from the US. We had Underworld, a classic electronic act from the 90s. And this year, once again, I'm doing it. So it's really an amazing thing. It's not what people think of me when they think about me. Like they don't say, oh, Ronaldo, the music curator. They think about me more with my lawyer side of things. But it's something that I'm very happy to be still participating in. And of course, I do that because I take music very seriously. And I research about it all the time, and I read about it all the time, and of course I listen to a lot of music, a lot of radio all the time, and that's why I'm doing this. But thanks for asking. Like, I'm very happy to be able to talk about that as well.
No, it looks amazing, and I'm a fan of music myself, and I think also sometimes we disregard other mediums of communication and research when sometimes it's the thing that brings together or enables to bridge certain digital divide, or even like, I think just simply communication divide between different cultures, nations. So for example, your documentary, your docu-series, Express of Futuro. And I wanted to ask you, what was your original idea behind that? Was that also a desire to use other mediums of communication to touch people, to educate people?
Well, Thank you. Well, it's interesting because if you work on technology policy, you have to be interested in the human experience as a whole, right? So when I talk about music, it's not that it's completely divorced from tech policy. Actually, the very opposite, right? So the music business was the first one to be transformed by technology. And that actually brought up a lot of lessons. So every human activity is now being transformed by technology again, especially because we are seeing the emergence of AI. So if you're not interested in what humans do, you're not a good fit for technology policy, because what technology policy does is precisely to try and understand and actually have a practical instance about what you should do because of the how life is being transformed by technology. So that's why I think that if you want to be a really important in the sense of having an impact scholar or practitioner in technology policy, you'd better be interested in the business of being a human being, right? So that's my approach to it. And the documentary series that I do is precisely about that. So every year I do a season of this documentary series, and each year is in a different place. So I've done like two series of 10 episodes in the United States. I've done one series in China. I've done one series, also one season in Africa, in different countries, including Mozambique, Kenya, Ghana, and quite a few others. In the more recent season, which was actually premiering just like 2 days ago, it was in the Amazon. So I traveled in the Amazon to understand what is the impact of technology in the forest and in the region. And every time I go to a different place, I learn a lot. So I learn a lot about what is the impact of technology in Africa, what is the importance of technology for China. And in the Amazon, I was very surprised to witness the arrival of Starlink, you know, the company by Elon Musk. And I was very surprised to see that the entire population that lives in the forest, even in very remote areas, either if you are a person who lives by the river, or if you are a traditional indigenous group or nation that live inside the forest in a very remote area, they all are being connected right now by Starlink. So everything that we know about the Amazon is going to change in the next 2 years because of this connectivity. This is brand new. Like if you live in São Paulo or in Bangalore or in Johannesburg, we have been connected for 20 plus years. But for a lot of the populations in the Amazon, it will be their first contact with the internet and with technology, with smartphones and with computers and so on. And the show talks a lot about that. So it shows people being connected in remote areas. And it also talks about the geopolitical issues around Starlink, the issues that Brazil will have to face, because I'm very fearful of Brazil becoming dependent on Starlink, a single provider, basically connecting the entire region. That will bring a lot of power in the hands of Elon Musk over the Amazon. And in my view, Brazil must respond to that by bringing more connectivity, not less. We should build our own networks in the region. We should make sure that there is competition to Starlink and so on. So it's a very interesting moment, and that's what the series is about. Like, it's going to places and spending a lot of time there to basically understand how technology is being impactful and changing people's lives and so on.
Like, responding to that a little bit, I just saw actually a new, like, new research just being produced like 2 days ago about trains, so about AI and like different countries' placement when it comes to innovation, research, patent producing. And actually Brazil made a big jump in that ranking. I think it's like 10 or something like that, which I was kind of surprised by. And I saw actually an interview of you that, yeah, reiterated that point, that Brazil not only needs to be a consumer of technology, but also needs to be a producer of its own technology. But practically, what does that entail? Increased connectivity? Does it entail like having your own Wi-Fi? Does it entail using like own data protection centers? So across LATAM, Latin America, we've seen increased desire like by state and governments to have that technology. But we've also seen, for example, in the case of Argentina, backlash when it comes to using, utilizing those different technologies. Maybe what's your point of view about that in the case of Brazil?
Absolutely. I usually say that a lot, that Brazil is a huge consumer of technology. Brazilians are always early adopters, and they're very enthusiastic about technology. I think other places in the world, especially now, they look at social media and whatever new things are coming with a very pessimistic way, while Brazilians still look into technology as a sort of something that can bring up opportunities and so on. So as a result, Brazilians spend a lot of time online. They like new stuff. So whenever, for instance, TikTok came, like Brazilians were early adopters, and actually also AI. So ChatGPT, for instance, the first country that Sam Altman actually decided to visit in his world tour, right after he was testifying at the US Congress, was actually Brazil. And he flew directly from DC, where he was basically with the Congress members in his testimony, directly to Rio de Janeiro. And actually, I know that as well, because he asked us to organize a meeting with the Brazilian scientific community. So we organized that for him. I got to meet him, and we spent like some time together when he was in Brazil. And I asked him, I said, why are you in Rio? You were in DC yesterday. And he said, we selected the countries because of the number of users of ChatGPT. And Rio de Janeiro in Brazil is actually one of the cities in the world in which there are more users of ChatGPT. So I was actually surprised, but not that much, when he talked about that. So that speaks to the fact that Brazilians are very early adopters, even of something that is new, as ChatGPT was like a couple of months ago. And but the challenge for the country is exactly that. We cannot be consumers forever. We need to be producers of technology. Brazil is already competitive in many areas in that field. So, for instance, it's important to remember that Brazil is where Embraer comes from. Embraer is the airplane leader for a lot of segments. So Brazilian planes are flying over China, the US, Europe, and many other countries right now. So we are pretty good at doing mid-sized jets. Other places of aerospace industry, but we can do more. And for instance, Embraer is now developing what we call an eVTOL. It's an electric vehicle that lands and takes off vertically, which can be a promise for how you build new commuting systems for global cities. And that is also coming from Brazil. But we need more. We do have technology also embedded in our agribusiness. So Brazil is doing well also in how it's developing technology for new types of plant varieties and also bringing some adaptation to different varieties of plants for the Brazilian climate. So that makes Brazil very competitive in the agribusiness as well. But my perception is that we can go beyond, and an important part of my work is precisely to make that happen. So to make Brazil be more competitive in the global scenario, and also that we can, become not only consumers, but also producers of technology more and more.
So when we talk about data and maybe a way forwards, as we've seen the passing of the ratification of the EU AI Act last week, I think, five, 6 days ago. Do you think, as I know you've co-created Brazil Bills of Rights and then Brazil National IoT Plan, do you think regulations should also be something that the so-called Global South should drop upon? And then I'm also want to make a parallel maybe with China in the sense of like, how do you see regulation being like evolving? Do you think there's ability for Brazil to, for example, make an alliance with other Latin countries or even China to do so? How is growing legislation around data protection also helping or maybe hindering the population?
Yeah, that's an important issue, because I, for myself, I'm not such a big fan of the AI Act. I think it changed a little bit before it was approved, but not that I think it's a problem. What I am skeptical about the AI Act is that I don't believe in a one-size-fits-all piece of regulation. And as you know, Europe has become this kind of regulatory superpower, which has been really successful in exporting its regulations worldwide. So Brazil does have a data protection law that basically mirrors the European GDPR. So our law is pretty much a transplant from GDPR into Brazilian law. And with the AI Act, we were actually going in the same direction. So if you look to Brazil right now, there is a piece of legislation in Congress that basically replicates the AI Act. It's a draft bill, so it's not been approved yet. But if you look at the text, it's pretty much the same structure of the AI Act before the changes that happened in the last few weeks. But I don't like that for the following reason. I think in terms of data protection, Europe had already an extensive experience of decades with data protection. So we know what works and we know what doesn't work. So when you basically had GDPR influencing Brazilian law, we knew what to expect. You know, there were like maybe 30 years, even before the GDPR, of tradition of protecting data in Europe. So that was something that had been tested very thoroughly. However, the AI Act is brand new, even to Europe. We don't know if it's going to be successful. We don't know what the consequences will be. So instead of basically just using that template, I would prefer that Brazil would come up with its own regulatory model rather than basically adopting a European one. And for doing that, we first need to answer the question, what do we want from AI? So what does Brazil want from it, from the local perspective? Once we are capable of answering that question, then we can basically build the regulation around it, almost like a reverse engineering. If you know where you want to go, you can basically build in reverse all the regulatory measures in order to get there. So that's what I'm working in Brazil right now. I'm doing everything that I can so that Brazil can answer the question, what we want from AI. And once we answer that question, then we can basically, in a very swift way, build the regulation in order to get there. So that's part of what I'm doing right now.
As I know that Brazil AI development has not only compounded inequalities within the countries, but also reinforced like already existing like institutional mechanisms that were maybe hindering some social development. How do you produce regulation that enables to have maybe like bottom to top innovation or bottom to top like knowledge learning loop? Are you doing that through a risk-based perspective? Are you doing that by a case-by-case? How do we create regulation that matters?
Yeah, that's important. And again, we need to answer what we want from AI, right? So just to give you an example, one thing that Brazil needs to improve is basically education and education quality. And one of the reasons is around 30% of the Brazilian society does have access to very good quality education, because those are the richer families. Those are the ones that can pay for private schools and universities and so on. And so they don't complain about the quality of education at all, because they have like global level education at reach. However, the other 70%, which is the absolute majority of the country, they depend on public schools and they depend on universities that are, you know, public as well, which are hard to get in if you are from a poor family. So for that segment of the population, our majority, AI can actually play a role, because one of the big differences between the rich and the poor families is that if you're wealthy, you can pay for private tutors that can basically teach you outside of the class time and so on. And if you're a poor family, you cannot pay for a tutor. Maybe even your school, even the professors are not as trained as they should be. And AI can actually bridge part of that gap. So if Brazil answers the question, what do we want from AI, as like we want AI to improve our educational system right away and to give opportunities for even poor students, poor families, to basically have access to something that can help you with homework, help you study, help you to have access to knowledge and so on, that is great. I see that as actually an opportunity for the country. But of course, that does not obfuscate the bigger picture, which is very complicated. It involves the geopolitics of AI and so on. But I think we have to think about AI in terms of how it can be immediately applied as well. And a lot of the debate is focused on the obvious problems, which involve like disappearing jobs and disappearing social dynamics of opportunities because of the massive concentration that AI can actually produce. But we do have to look also into the opportunities. We have to look into the fact that that might be a good thing as well for educational purposes in a country like Brazil. And just to one last thing to say, if we think about China, China, a couple of years ago, they cracked down on the private tutoring market, right? Precisely out of these worries, precisely out of the fear of becoming similar to Brazil, right? In which you have a segment of the Chinese society that would be happy with a very high quality private education to the point that they don't care about public education any longer. We've seen that happening in Brazil, and China apparently didn't want that to happen to China. So they basically cracked down on the possibility of, you know, having these different types of tutors for different portions of the Chinese society. And in Brazil, maybe technology can be the opposite. It can be the one of the very few opportunities we might have to actually equalize access, at least to a portion of good education, which will be, you know, the opportunity to have AI playing that role. But just to give you a sense that this is a long conversation, and I think besides the usual employment and trust and safety concerns, it's important to look at the more details of the picture, because it's something that can be easily overlooked as well.
Yes, and I mean, okay, so education, so thinking about, for example, national education plan, such as the one that was developed by Lula before 2010, okay. And then coming back onto that parallel with China, so when I think about China cracking down on its education sector, I also think about now the increasing role that companies like Tencent and Alibaba representing like 85% of the digital penetration in China represents. And then I think about the public policy mix, right? How do we, what's the tensions between the state and the private sector and how those tensions are different across every countries? Maybe in Brazil, do you see private sector and specifically telecommunications playing an important role in that fine-grained developments, whether it comes to education, digital penetration through connectivity, so internet, broadcast, like broadband. Yeah.
Yeah, there is one thing that Brazil, for instance, has done, which I think is important. So there is this conversation about digital public infrastructure and about digital public goods. And I think this is extremely important. So I think Brazil is doing well in that field. India is certainly doing very well in that field. So India has created the Aadhaar infrastructure, the Aadhaar stack, which is fascinating. But Brazil is not really lagging behind India at all. And actually, in some aspects, I think Brazil is ahead of India and even China in terms of digital public infrastructure. So I'll give you an example, which is the fact that Brazil has created a public infrastructure for digital payments that we call PIX. So instead of going the China way, in which you have two companies, Alibaba and Tencent, being responsible for the entire payment system in the country, and those are two private companies, Brazil has created a payment system that is actually open source. It was developed by Brazil's central bank, and it was deployed a couple of years ago. And it was basically a revolution in the way that payments are made in Brazil. So it has the same effect as China. So you can pay everything now with a QR code. You can basically transfer money immediately to someone else in an irrevocable way. And the interesting thing is, it's not a product of a company. It's definitely a digital public infrastructure run by means of open source software, completely auditable, in which players adhere to its usage voluntarily. And even people in Brazil, they only use it if they want it. And the interesting thing is that it was massively adopted. It very quickly reached 100 million users and growing. And this is really remarkable. So I think this is an interesting way to go. So I am myself very favorable of this digital public infrastructure approach. And I think India is doing a good job. Brazil is doing a good job. And I think it presents some solutions that can be very interesting for different places too.
Are you hopeful about international organizations taking the lead also in promoting those digital rights?
Yeah, I think international organizations, they face so many limitations in what they can do in terms of developing infrastructure. So, for instance, take the digital identity issue. That's something that I care a lot about. The UN does have a couple of programs about it, but I think the most effective initiative in practical terms in this regard is actually an Indian initiative, which is the creation of the MOSIP network, M-O-S-I-P, which basically creates a digital identity tool that can be deployed by different countries. So it saves the design time, it saves the basically the planning time, because it can be deployed like quite easily. And now it's been adopted in quite a few countries. So the Philippines, also Ethiopia, and quite a few others. And as a result, the MOSIP initiative has already more than 100 million identities generated to its tools, right? I don't think the UN has done anything similar to that. I think the UN plays an extremely important role in different things, including in refugee crisis and others. But it was a country initiative using open source technology that actually deployed a digital public infrastructure that was adopted across different countries and actually, you know, being important for so many people. Like we're talking here about 100 million people in different places. So I think the future might look like more like MOSIP than something coming from the UN. So when I think about AI, I think there can be a digital public infrastructure view of AI as well. So I look into the open source AI models and I feel very enthusiastic about them. And I definitely see AI a very critical infrastructure for society in the present and in the future. And I always think with myself, what can be the public component of AI? How can we deploy that infrastructure in a way that basically is not only controlled by private companies, but have also a public interest component to it? So this is something that I'm thinking about. And actually, in 2024, I am organizing a conference at Bellagio, the center at the that is run by the Rockefeller Foundation in Italy, about what I'm calling technodiversity, which is precisely looking into AI from a perspective of diversity. So diversity of people, diversity of institutions, diversity of models, diversity in the idea of intelligence. So intelligence is such a diverse thing that humans manifest that cannot be, we cannot settle for one type of intelligence, and also diversity of how AI is deployed, right? So should it be private companies only? Should it be, you know, the public component to it as well? Should it be private or open source? So that's what I'm trying to bring under this idea of techno-diversity, right? So we'll be organizing that event in Bellagio, and we hope to build a network around this idea. We are actually working on it right now as we speak. So Bellagio will be one of the milestones for that effort. And we are planning quite a few other conferences as well in different parts of the world in order to propel that network of techno diversity as it applies to AI. But I think that's absolutely important. The worst thing that can happen is that we have one model fits all, that we have one single model on which we all depend, one model that basically uses one type of intelligence only. And I think that would be, at least for me, very worrisome, because I would like to see more diversity, including on AI. And I think that effort speaks to that.
I've personally been quite appalled by even AI research, or like the New York Times article just promoting, for example, men. And I think it's not only a gender, but also a cultural, like, minority being represented divide. And I think that we need to be really conscious of that, because when it comes to representation, when it comes to circles of power, we do see the same type of people again and again.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Yes. And I think, as I mentioned, diversity of people is extremely important, but we have to go beyond that too. So AI is not an easy thing. It has to be diverse in so many different levels. And I think it's important not to overlook not even one of them. So that's an important thing as well.
My last question to kind of conclude this interview would be, how has your sense of purpose across your career, but also across maybe your personal life, evolved? So since you started working in that law firm, how has it evolved also through personal interests like music? Yes.
I think the way that I found to basically summarize what is my sense of purpose is basically, I don't think there's a good way, but it could be the fact that I try as much as I can to fight for the commons, in the sense that my entire career has been in order to support, promote, and keep the commons healthy. So the cultural commons, and that includes music, that includes different human experiences of culture as well. So infrastructure commons and everything else that has to do with public goods. So at least that's something that I care a lot about. As we talked in the beginning, it all started with music, which is something that is shared by all of us. And I think I got really excited when I saw Napster turn the entire musical production of humanity into a cultural commons, at least while it lasted, until it was defeated because it was a pirate platform. But I have never lost that, original spark, which is, I think we can think about communal spaces in a very deep way, including in economic terms. And I think that's what motivates me a lot in the end.